8.
"I'm sorry, sir, but you can't get in," the guard in front of the gate said. The gate itself was made of riveted steel and was solidly set into a high stone wall capped with many strands of barbed wire.
"What do you mean I can't get in? I have been ordered to glue post!"
I shouted in my best military obnoxious manner.
"Now press the button or whatever else you do to unlock that thing!"
"I can't open it, sir. The vest is sealed from the inside. I'm stationed with the outside guard detail."
"I want to see your superior officer."
"Here I am,"
a cold voice said in my ear.
"What is this disturbance?"
When I turned around, I looked at his lieutenant's bar, and he looked at my flight major's double cross, and I won that argument. He led me to the guardhouse, and there was a lot of calling back and forth on the TV phone until he handed it to me, and I looked a steely-eyed colonel in the face. I had already lost this argument.
"The base is sealed, Flight Major," he said.
"I have orders to report here, sir."
"You were to report here yesterday. You have overstayed your leave."
"I'm sorry, sir. Must have been an error in recording. My orders read report today."
I held them up and saw that the reporting date was the previous day. That drunkard Vaska had gotten me into the trouble he deserved himself. The colonel smiled with all the sweetness of a king cobra in rut.
"If the mistake were in the orders, Flight Major, there would certainly be no difficulty. Since the mistake was yours, Lieutenant, we know where the error lies. Report to the security entrance."
I hung up the phone, and the guard lieutenant, grinning evilly, handed me a set of lieutenant's bars. I unclipped my double crosses and accepted the humbler rank. I hoped promotion was as fast as demotion in the space armada. A guard detail marched me along the wall to a smaller airlock type of entrance, and I was passed through. My credentials and orders were examined, my fingerprints taken, and in a few minutes I was through the last gate and inside the base of Blue Post. A car was summoned. A private soldier took my bags. We drove to the officer's quarters, and I was shown to my room. And all the time I kept my eyes open. Not that there was anything fascinating to see. See one military base and you've seen them all. Buildings, tents, chaps in uniform doing repetitious jumping, heavy, expensive equipment all painted the same color, that sort of thing. What I had to find out would not be that easy to uncover. My bags were dumped in the tiny room, salutes exchanged, the soldier left, and a voice spoke hoarsely from the other bed.
"You don't happen to have a drink on you, do you?"
I looked closely and saw that what I at first thought was a bundle of crumpled blankets now appeared to contain a scrawny individual who wore dark glasses. The effort of talking must have exhausted him, and he groaned, adding another breath of alcoholic vapor to the already rich atmosphere of the room.
"It so happens that I do,"
I said, opening the window.
"My name is Vaska.
Do you prefer any particular brand?"
"Otrov."
I could think of no drink by that title, so presumably it was my roommate's name. Taking the flask with the most potent beverage from my collection, I poured him half a glass. He seized it with trembling fingers and drained it while shudders racked his frame. It must have done some good, because he sat up in bed and held out the glass for more.
"We blast off in 2 days,"
he said, sniffing his drink.
"This really isn't paint remover, is it?"
"No, it just smells that way to fool the MPs."
"Where to?"
"Oh, don't make jokes so early in the morning. You know we never know what planet we're hitting. Security. Or are you with security?"
He blinked suspiciously in my direction. I would have to watch the questions until I knew more. I forced a smile and poured a drink for myself.
"A joke. I don't feel so good myself. I woke up a flight major this morning."
And now you're a lieutenant. Easy come, easy go."
"They didn't come that easy."
"Sorry, figure of speech. I've always been a lieutenant, so I would know how the others feel. You, couldn't just tip a little more into this glass. Then I'll be able to dress, and we can get over to the club and get into some serious drinking. It's going to be awful, all those weeks without drink until we get back."
Another fact, The Cleond fought their battles refreshed with water. I wondered if I could. I sipped, and the disturbing thought that had been poking at me for some minutes surfaced. The real Vaska Hulja was back at the hotel, and would be discovered. And I could do nothing about it, because I was in this sealed base. Some of the drink went down the wrong pipe, and I coughed, and Otrov beat me on the back.
"I think it really is spent remover,"
he said gloomily, when I had stopped gasping and began to dress. As we walked to the officers' club, I was in no mood for communication, which Otrov probably blamed on my recent demotion. What to do? Drink seemed to be in order. It wasn't noon yet, and it would be wisest to wait until evening to crack out of the base. Face the problems as they arose. Right now I was in a perfect position to imbibe drink with my new peer group and gather information at the same time, which, after all, was the reason that I was here in the first place. Before leaving, I had slipped a tube of Kilauk pills into my pocket. One of these every 2 hours would produce a massive heartburn, but would also grab onto and neutralize most of the alcohol as soon as it hit the stomach. I would drink deep and listen, and stay sober. As we walked through the garish doorway of the club, I slipped one out and swallowed it. It was all rather depressing, particularly since I was sloshing the stuff down my throat as fast as I could drink it, and buying rounds for the others, and not feeling it at all. As the afternoon went on and thirsts increased, other officers appeared in the club, and there were soon a dozen other pilots crowded around our free-spending table, all drinking well and saying little of any interest.
"Drink! Drink!" I insisted. "Wanted gambling, don't need where we're going,"
and bought another round. There was a great deal said, as one might well imagine, about the flying characteristics of various ships, and I filed all relevant details. And much mumbling over old campaigns.
"I dived from 50,000, planted the bombs, pulled up," and that sort of thing.
The only thing remarkable about all this was the unsullied record of victories. I knew the Cleond armed forces were good, but looking at this collection of drunks almost made it impossible to believe they could be that good. But apparently they were. There were endless boasting tales of victory after victory and nothing else. And after a period, I too came to believe. These boys were good, and the space armada of Cleond a winner. It was all too depressing. By evening, there was a literal falling away of the original drinkers, though their places at the table were filled quickly enough. When one of them slid to the floor, the servants would gently carry him off. I realized that I was the last of the originals, so no one would notice if I also made an exit in this apparently traditional manner. Letting my eyes close, I sank deep into my chair, hoping this would do, since I did not relish a trip to the debris-littered floor. It took them some minutes to notice I was no longer functioning, but eventually they did. Hard hands caught me at knees and armpits, and I was hauled off. When the footsteps had rattled away, I opened my eyes to a sort of dim chamber whose walls were lined with bunks. Nearby me was the gaping O of Otrov's mouth, snoring away in his cups, as were the others. No one noticed when I pulled on my gloves and went to the door that opened into the company street and let myself out. It was almost dark and I had to leave the camp, and I had not the slightest idea of how I could do it. The gates were impossible. I strolled along the wall to the first one, sealed and bolted shut, solid steel with a brace of guards to see that the locks weren't tampered with. I walked on. There were guards every 100 paces or so along the wall, and I assumed that there were an equal or greater number of electronic safeguards as well. As evening approached, searchlights were turned on that illuminated the outside of the wall and glinted from the barbed wire that topped it. Admittedly, all this was to keep anyone from getting in, but it worked equally well in the opposite direction. I walked on, trying to fight off the black depression that still threatened to overwhelm me. I passed through a medium-sized atmosphere craft area, 2 crossed runways and some hangars, with a collection of lumbering jet transports standing about. For a moment I considered stealing one of these, but where would I land without being captured? I had to be in this city tonight, not zipping off to parts unknown. Beyond the aircraft was a high chainmetal fence that cut off the spaceship area. Getting in there would be easy enough, but what would it accomplish? I could see the same high outer wall stretching off into the distance. There was a rumble in the sky, and bright lights lanced down. I turned around and watched, sunk in gloom as a Delta Wing fighter settled in heavily for a landing. It looked like one of the same type that had strafed me at Pot Rock. The tires squealed when it hit, and the jets roared with reverse thrust. And I was running forward, even while the idea was half-formed in my mind. Madness? Perhaps. But in my line of business, crookery, you learn to rely on hunches and trained reflexes. And while I ran, the parts all fell into place, and I saw that this was it. Sweet, fast, clean, and dangerous, the way I like things. I took a false mustache out of my pocket and fixed it on my lip as I ran. The jet turned and taxied off to a hard stand, and I trotted after it. A car came out to meet it, and a crew of mechanics began to service the jet. One of them unloaded a ladder and placed it next to the cockpit as the top of the canopy opened like an alligator's mouth. I ran a little faster as the pilot climbed down and made for the car. He was just climbing in when I came stumbling up and he returned my salute. A burly individual in heavy flying gear, the golden crescent of a major on his collar.
"Excuse me, sir," I gasped, "but the commandant asked me to make sure you had the papers."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
he grumbled, sliding into his seat. He sounded tired. I climbed into the back.
"Then you don't know? Oh, God, driver, get going as fast as possible."
The driver did, since that was his job, and I slipped the tube out of the holder in my hip pocket. When we were out of sight of the jet, I raised it to my lips. "Major," I said, and he turned his head and grunted. I puffed. He grunted again and raised his hand towards the little dart stuck in his cheek, then slumped forward. I caught him before he fell.
"Driver, stop! Something has happened to the Major!"
The driver, obviously not a man of much imagination, took a quick look at the slumped figure and hit the brake. As soon as we skidded to a stop, away from any buildings, I was happy to see, I let him have a second narco dart, and he went off to join the Major in Dreamland. I laid them both on the ground and stripped off the officer's flying suit and helmet. With a little bit of struggling, I managed to pull the things over my own uniform, then strapped on the helmet and pulled the tinted goggles down over my eyes. All of this took less than a minute. I left the dozing pair in each other's arms and headed the car back to the plane. So far, so good. But this had been the easiest part. I stood on the brake so that the car screeched, bucked, and skidded to a stop on the hard stand.
"Emergency!"
I shouted, leaping from the car and running to the ladder.
"Unhook this thing so I can take off!"
The mechanics merely gaped at me, making no move towards the umbilical wires and hoses that connected the plane to the servicing pit. I wheeled the nearest one about and used the toe of my boot to move him in the right direction. He got the message clearly, and the others now understood as well. They went to work. All except a grizzled non-com with a sleeve covered with hash marks and stripes and a face covered with suspicion. He rolled over and looked me up and down.
"This is Major Lopter's personal plane, sir. Haven't you made a mistake?"
"Not as big a mistake as you are making interfering with me. How long has it been since you were a private?"
He looked at me in thought for a moment, then turned away without another word. I headed for the plane. As I climbed the ladder, I saw that the non-com was busy at the radio in the car. This was a mistake on my part. I should have done something about that radio. As I was getting into the cockpit, he dropped the radio and bellowed,
"Stop that man! He has no orders for this flight!"
The man steadying the ladder reached for my leg, and I put my foot on his chest and pushed. I sent the ladder after him and dropped into the seat. The situation had rapidly developed in a direction that was not to my liking. I had planned on having enough time to familiarize myself with the controls before I fired up the engines. Although I had plenty of jet hours, I had never been in a Cleondian one before. Not only didn't I know where the starter was, but I did some pretty desperate fumbling before I even found the switch for the instrument lights. As I flicked it on, the ladder smacked back against the side of the plane. I hated old, efficient non-coms, the backbone of the military. Now I had to take out time to open the flying suit and grope inside it for my pockets. A few happy gas and sleep grenades cleared away the mechanics for the moment. Some lay cheerfully unconscious, while the others laughed themselves sick. The non-com had cowardly stayed out of range and was back on the radio again. I studied the instruments. There, the little black knob with Palginji on it. When I slapped it, the jets whined and rumbled to life. A rocket slug crashed through the open canopy above my head, and I ducked, cursing. As I kicked in the throttle, I saw the non-com kneeling to take careful aim. The plane began to move, slowly. His gun flared again, and I felt the vibration as the slug buried itself in the seat, which was probably armored. My first bit of luck. I flipped the tail so it pointed at the gunman, which put the armor between me and him and gave him a good blast of jet exhaust in the face. The plane bucked and shuddered and moved forward again, and I saw the torn fuel hose flapping in the wind stream and pumping out its vital juices. Those idiots hadn't disconnected it. I didn't know where the fuel gauge was on the cluttered instrument board, nor did I want to look at it. Logic told me that gravity would bleed the fuel out a lot slower than the pumps had forced it into the tanks, but logic had nothing to do with this. I had a vision of the jets dying out here in the middle of the field while the forces of the enemy closed in around me. I could feel my blood pressure going up like an express elevator. My busy little non-com friend was obviously still working on the radio, because when I turned onto the runway, I saw that some trucks were moving into position to block it, and something that looked suspiciously like an armored car was roaring up in the background. I cut the throttle back almost all the way and ducked my head down to read the instrument panel again. What I was looking for wasn't there. Then I noticed another bank of switches on one side and painfully spelled out their dim messages in the bad light. Isbasivanji. There it was. I looked up and saw that I was about to crash into the first truck. Men were bailing out and running in all directions. My feet paddled about as I groped for the wheel brakes, and I threw the rudder hard over. I finally found the brakes, stood on the right one, and did a shuddering turn. About a half meter of wingtip tore off the front of the truck. There was the orange blast of a gun as someone fired at me, but I have no idea where the slug went. Then the jet was around, and I was belting back in the opposite direction, this time at full throttle. The runway lights were streaming by, faster and faster, and I had to keep one hand on the wheel while I groped for the belts and harnesses with the other. One of the buckles was missing, and the end of the runway was coming up before I found out that I was sitting on it. I clicked it into place and grabbed the wheel with both hands as I ran out of runway. The jet did not have flying speed. The nose was mushy and would not lift when I pulled back on it. Then I was bumping across the graded dirt, heading straight for that stone wall I had been looking at all evening. Faster and faster, to a certain collision.